as a cable installer, he co-founded the Ruthless Bastards, a team of doom junkies who became his closest friends. Though Fuchs said he probably wouldn't be hanging out with some of the younger, geekier clan members if it wasn't for the game, their friendships, he said, ran deep. The last time he stopped to check the clock, he was plugging in 6 hours a night. Despite the camaraderie, Fuchs, like most players, rarely spoke to his brothers in person or on the phone, preferring instead the anonymity of the internet's chat channels, the locker rooms of Quake. At any time, day or night, he could log on and trash-talk his way into a pickup game. "The internet is my real home," he said. "At work, I'm sentient, but I find myself walking around in a daze because I'm so bored with the usual stuff. My job, meeting people who aren't interesting. When I get home and start shooting the shit with the guys and start playing, that's when I get excited." Although he was well known online for his wit and skills, Fuchs readily acknowledged the absurdity of being underappreciated, if not unknown, everywhere else. "The mainstream just sees them as little games," he said. "Sometimes I think I'm wasting my time, but I guess this is my chance to play Rock God for 5 minutes. Everyone wants to be remembered. I'm really good at video games, so maybe this is how I can do it. In some future Olympics," he joked, "the weightlifting team will be standing there, and right next to them, a bunch of weird-looking guys with big, bulging foreheads." Fuchs wasn't the only id fan with big dreams. One of his chief competitors in Impulse 9, the legendary game girl Stevie Case, was just beginning to transform her life through Quake. Stevie was among the leaders of a new generation of young women who were defying the stereotype of the adolescent boy gamer. Raised in the small town of Olathe, Kansas, the daughter of a social worker and a school teacher, she'd always had a strong competitive nature. She took to sports early on, becoming the first and only girl on the neighborhood t-ball team, much to the distress of the local dads, whose boys she regularly beat. By high school, Stevie had been voted Athlete of the Year and parlayed her popularity into becoming student government president. An exceptional student, she was among those flown to the White House to meet President Clinton. She wanted to be a politician. Once enrolled at the University of Kansas, she overachieved even more, committing herself on the fast track to law school. She earned straight A's, ran for student government. She became a member of Mensa. Then, Quake took hold. She was dating a guy, Tom Entropy Kismay, who was deep in the throes of the game's grip. But unlike the women online who despaired over their men's obsessions, Stevie was eager to compete. Quake was everything that a woman was not supposed to be. Loud, violent, aggressive. It was also creative, programmed to be even more extensible than Doom, thus giving rise to even more elaborate modifications. Stevie wanted it all. Soon enough, she found herself at the top of her boyfriend's clan, Impulse 9, facing off in the ultimate showdown with their rivals, the Ruthless Bastards. As the countdown on the screen began that day, Stevie slipped on her headphones and began nervously clicking her mouse. "You okay, honey?" asked her boyfriend, ready at a computer beside her. Reflected in his screen, he resembled a hydrocephalic Emilio Estevez. Stevie gave him the thumbs up and said, "I'm fine, hon." Down the hall, in the Ruthless Bastards room, Fuchs sucked the last of his cigarette and reached for the keyboard. "Okay, brothers," he said, "let's win." But when the dust cleared, Stevie and her clan had clocked Fuchs' Bastards, making Impulse 9 the undisputed champions. Leaning back at her PC, Stevie slipped off her headphones and ran her hand through her hair. Victory felt good. She was powerful, supreme, connected with the gamers of the world, even the baddest of them all, her hero, John Romero. "I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a politician. I'm a gamer," she resolved. "And I'm going to Dallas." The only place that wasn't in the throes of Quake Deathmatch as 1997 arrived, it seemed, was a tiny company in Texas, id Software. No one was screaming or cursing or smashing keyboards into the ground. With the renovations complete, the war room was divided into a suite of small private offices. The pool table had been sold, the foosball shipped away. Everything was, if not respectable, respectably quiet, and everyone in the company knew why. John Romero, ace programmer, current rich person, deathmatch surgeon, was gone. American McGee felt Romero's absence from the moment he walked by his old office and saw the empty chair. Romero, even with his problems, had always bridged the gap between the owners and the employees. And there was no one who could even remotely take his place. Carmack didn't take into account that he had let go more than just John Romero, American thought. He had let go the soul of any video game company. The fun. American wasn't the only one feeling gloomy. Quake's shareware retail experiment had proved disastrous. In theory, id was going to cut out retailers by allowing gamers to buy the shareware and then call an 800 number to place an order and receive a password that would unlock the rest of the game. But gamers wasted no time hacking the shareware to unlock the full version of the game for free. Worse, all the mundane aspects of distribution and order fulfillment were spinning out of control. In a desperate measure, id tried to put the brakes on the retail shareware, but it was too late. They were stuck with almost 150,000 CDs sitting in a warehouse. Mike Wilson, id's biz guy, put the burden on their publisher, GTI, forcing them not only to absorb the inventory, but to increase id's royalty before releasing the full version of Quake into the retail market. For GTI's Ron Chimowitz, it was just more of the kid's audacity. Id had even made him wait to release the retail version of the game until it could rake in as many sales as possible through the shareware. Ron didn't get the game until after the lucrative holiday season, and by that time, the shareware debacle had left its scar. Sales were good, with 250,000 units shipped, but not a phenomenon like Doom 2. Id decided its days with GTI were over. Ron was disappointed, but with his company doing fine without id, his attitude was good riddance. Mike and his cohort Jay Wilbur had another plan. Turn id into a publishing empire, beginning with their next game, a sequel to Quake, called Quake 2. "We don't need GTI," Jay said to the owners. "We don't need Activision. We can do this all on our own. We can keep the benefit, but we need an organization to do that. In order to do that right, we need to hire more people. And that can be id Publishing, here, there, or yonder. It can be a completely separate company whose character is to completely handle our product." Kevin and Adrian were intrigued by the idea, but knew it was Carmack's decision. Even though they were now the majority owners, there was no question about who was really in charge. Carmack's technology had long been the heart of id. With Romero out of the way, it was completely unfettered. The last thing Carmack wanted to do now was spoil the company by turning it into an empire. That had been Romero's wish, not his. Despite Carmack's battles with his mother's conservative fiscal ideals, he himself had become quite the conservative businessman. As long as he was in the company, he told Adrian and Kevin, id was going to stay small and let a new publisher, like Activision, handle their next game. With Romero gone, Carmack felt happier than he had in some time. No more grandiose statements about stuff they were working on. No more all-night deathmatching. No more poison. Now, with the other guys beginning work on Quake 2, using the existing graphics engine, he was free to experiment. No deadlines, no pressure, just pure immersive learning. Carmack's first project was to explore the burgeoning hardware for 3D computer graphics. In the past, only arcade machines had been designed specifically to improve or accelerate 3D graphics. With robust computer games like Doom and Quake, however, startup companies saw an opportunity finally to bring 3D acceleration to home machines. This would be done by putting powerful graphics processing chips onto special cards that could be inserted into an existing PC. One manufacturer, called 3DFX, convinced Carmack to port a version of Quake in a programming language called OpenGL, which could run with its debut line of Voodoo 3D accelerator cards. Carmack completed the task in a weekend and uploaded the OpenGL version to the web for free. The hardcore gamers flipped at the results, which made the game at least 20% faster and smoother. Once they saw 3D acceleration, they would never go back, and they eagerly spent the few hundred dollars to upgrade their machines. Other game programmers, as was becoming protocol, followed Carmack's lead and programmed for 3DFX's cards. More card manufacturers jumped into the game. A new high-tech industry had begun. The success buoyed Carmack's other pet project, Quake World, a free program he wrote and distributed to improve Quake's multiplayer capabilities. With OpenGL improving Quake's graphics and Quake World improving Quake's networking, the game had never looked or played better. But Carmack's hard work couldn't save id from the reverberations of Quake's stressful development. Before long, id began to hemorrhage employees. It started with biz guy Jay Wilbur, who quit after his 4-year-old son asked him, "How come all the other daddies go to the baseball games and you never do?" Programmer Michael Abrash soon followed suit, returning to the structure and sanctity of Microsoft. Level designer Sandy Peterson, who had been on the skids with the management since clashing over Quake's design, was let go. Mike Wilson, marketing whiz, and Sean Green, tech supporter and deathmatch fiend, gave notice. They were going to work for Romero. The gaming community, already reeling from the split of Carmack and Romero, became ablaze with speculation until Carmack finally addressed them in an unusually personal and lengthy email interview. "Lots of people will read what they like into the departures from id," he wrote, "but our development team is at least as strong now as it has ever been. Romero was pushed out of id because he wasn't working hard enough. I believe that 3 programmers, 3 artists, and 3 level designers can still create the best games in the world. We are scaling back our publishing biz so that we are mostly just a developer. This was always a major point of conflict with Romero. He wants an empire. I just want to create good programs. Everyone is happy now." Romero hit the highest button inside the gilded elevator of the Texas Commerce Building. 55 floors of bankers, lawyers, and oil moguls in the heart of downtown Dallas. Now, a 29-year-old gamer was bound for the top. Romero had been called here abruptly late one night by his real estate agent, who said he had to see this amazing penthouse that had become available. He was skeptical. Since leaving id to open his own company, he had seen dozens of spaces, but nothing was right, and there was everything at stake. Romero was essentially starting from scratch. Though he'd received an undisclosed multi-million-dollar buyout from his partners at id, Time magazine estimated his net worth to be $10 million, the terms required that he relinquish all rights to id products and royalties. No more money from Doom or Quake. More important, Romero was on a mission. After years of feeling repressed by Carmack's shackles, he was finally free to pursue his vision of what a game company, and ultimately a life could be. Not only was that vision big, but it was everything that id Software was not. "At id, the company was rolling in millions of dollars, and we just had walls," Romero lamented. "It was the whole Carmack idea of, I don't need anything on my walls. All I need is a table and a computer and a chair, instead of, okay, we've got a lot of money. Why not make it a really badass office?" Romero's new office wouldn't only be a fun place to work, it would be where a gamer could show the press, family, and friends that games had built an empire, and that the empire would be the ultimate place to make more games. When the elevator doors finally opened into the penthouse, it felt as though Romero was standing on top of the moon. The 2-story, 22,500-square-foot loft seemed to spill into the stars. The space was bare, but surrounded by a wraparound window view of the city and a seemingly endless 60-foot arched glass ceiling. Anywhere Romero spun, he saw the kaleidoscopic twinkle of lights. Evening lights from below, the celestial bodies up high. It was raw, waiting to be designed. Romero imagined a room full of pillows, a Vegas room with slot machines, a break shit room where you could just go around destroying things. But there were problems, the agent explained. The space was so big and windowed and close to the sun that it was extremely difficult to air condition. It was also expensive, $15 per square foot, or roughly $350,000 per month. For these reasons, and the fact that the space was just too weird for tenants like Payne Weber, Texas Commerce Bank, or the Petroleum Club, the penthouse remained empty. "No more," Romero said, eyes gleaming. "This is amazing. There is nothing like this. This is it," he declared. "This is a game company." He named it Dream Design. With his old friend and sidekick Tom Hall, Romero pitched the dream to eager publishers. Neither technology nor Carmack would be his ruler. In fact, he would simply license the Quake engine, which id had agreed to do, and make a game around it. He would have three designers, working on three games at a time in different genres. And he would give each designer a large enough staff to get the jobs done quickly. It wouldn't be just a game company. It would be an entertainment company. And the mantra of anything they produced would be loud and clear. "Design is law," Romero said. "What we design is what's going to be the game. It's not going to be that we design something and have to chop it up because the technology can't handle it or because some programmer says we can't do it. You design a game, you make it, and that's what you do. That's the law. It's the fucking design." His terms for publishers were brash. $3 million per game with a 40% royalty. Plus, he wanted to keep all the intellectual property rights, as well as rights to port his company's games to other platforms. Companies balked, but didn't back away. This was the age of vanity game development houses. Sid Meier, legendary designer of Civilization strategy games, had his own company, Firaxis. Will Wright, creator of the best-selling SimCity series, had his company, Maxis. Richard Garriott had Origin. A former employee of his named Chris Roberts would spawn off his own, Digital Anvil. After the success of Wolfenstein, Doom, and Quake, Romero was not just famous, he was bankable. Publishers flew him and Tom out first class, putting them up in $1,000-a-night suites in Beverly Hills and whisking them around in limousines to the best restaurants in town. The two felt giddy with the freedom and sense of possibilities. They washed away id's baggage with champagne. With Romero planning to do a shooter and Tom a role-playing adventure game, Dream Design needed one other designer for balance. That person would be Todd Porter, who was then heading up a Dallas developer called Seventh Level. Todd, whom Romero had met through an old soft disk friend, seemed energetic, upbeat, and, most important, a gamer. A real gamer. A veteran Apple II guy. The 36-year-old had originally gone to school to be a minister, but preaching, he discovered to his dismay, was as much about business as it was about spirituality. He didn't like the pressure he felt to have to land a sweet spot in some big church. So he dropped out of school and used the money to buy a computer. With his parents divorced, Todd had to do what he could to provide for the family. He moved to Iowa to study business. He took a brief stint as an exotic dancer with the stage name Preacher Boy. With the money he saved, Todd refined his programming skills and eventually landed a job with Richard Garriott's Origin Company in Austin. He soon left to found his own company with an artist, Jerry O'Flaherty, in Dallas. Tough times forced him to sell out to Seventh Level, however, and his dreams of his own company seemed dashed. That was until Romero walked in. Todd told Romero he had the business sense that would round out the team. Romero felt Todd indeed had a knack for selling the company. Plus, he could bring on Jerry, who could head up the art department. Over lunch at McDonald's, the four gamers agreed to join forces. They took notes on a napkin. All they needed was a name. Dream Design wasn't good enough, Romero decided. He wanted something more original, something short, punchy, powerful, scientific, intelligent. Tom suggested Ion. "The competition had better watch out," a friend quipped, "or they're going to get caught up in an Ion storm." Ion storm it would be. On Christmas Eve, Ion Storm closed a publishing deal with Eidos Interactive. Eidos was a British company that had been founded on the riches of South African gold mines and had recently scored a hit with a female-led shooter, kind of a sexy variation of Indiana Jones, called Tomb Raider. They were looking to develop more brand names. Romero was already among the biggest. They agreed to almost all Ion's terms. $3 million per game. But they offered to pay another $4 million for console rights. They also wanted to have an option on Ion's next three games, making it potentially a six-game deal. In total, it valued Ion Storm at $100 million. With the money in place, Romero, Tom, and Todd sketched plans for their dream games. Tom began cobbling together ideas for a sprawling and comedic intergalactic adventure game called Anachronox. Todd announced plans for a strategy title about body-snatching slugs called Doppelganger. And Romero outlined his ultimate title ever, an epic first-person shooter that would take its name from the mystical sword Carmack had tantalized him with in their Dungeons & Dragons game long ago. It was the weapon for which Romero had risked everything, the dreams of his partners, the fate of Carmack's game. He had made a deal with the demons to get the sword Daikatana. That time, it led to the end of the world. This time, it would lead to his conquering it. In Daikatana, the player would become Hiro Miyamoto, a Japanese biochemical student in 25th century Kyoto who must save the world from Keiji Mishima, an evil scientist who has stolen the Daikatana, Japanese for big sword, a magical blade invented by Miyamoto's ancestors. Using the sword's time-traveling powers, Mishima is altering history to his own corrupt ends, such as hijacking the cure for an AIDS-like disease. Faced with Hiro's threat, Mishima sends the young warrior on a wild, time-traveling goose chase between Kyoto, ancient Greece, Dark Ages Norway, and post-apocalyptic San Francisco. For added drama, Hiro is teamed with sidekicks, the shaft-like Superfly Johnson and the beautiful, brainy heroine, Mikiko. Daikatana embodied Romero's greatest ambitions. Every polygon of these grandiose worlds would have to be coded from scratch, interacting seamlessly with the characters in action. In addition to the complex nuances of the artificially intelligent characters, the game would require over 100 unique levels and monsters spread throughout what were essentially four games, roughly four times the size of Quake. Romero had spent years making games almost completely on his own. But for John Romero's Daikatana, as the game was officially named, there was no way to do everything himself, as he would have preferred. Romero proceeded to fill the ultimate gaming company with the ultimate gamers. Mike Wilson hoped finally to exercise all the outlandish marketing schemes he could never pull off at id. Sean Green, Romero's old deathmatch partner from id, was ready to help with coding. After Romero put the word out on the internet, rabid Doom and Quake fans swamped Ion Storm's email server with resumes and mods. Romero handpicked his favorites, figuring that any who could wow him with a fresh character or monster or level had a place in his dream posse. Romero, after all, was once just like them, flipping burgers, eschewing sleep, school, and relationships to make and play games. So what if all these young dudes never actually worked in the business before? If they had the passion, the predisposition for crunch, that was qualification enough. By early 1997, hardcore gamers who had been living and breathing Romero's games for years were road tripping to Ion Storm's temporary offices to work and deathmatch with their mentor. Brian Iserlo, who had achieved notoriety in college for his new Doom hacking parties, took a job after sending in an application essay written in the form of a medieval short story. Will LeCanto gave up his gig in the industrial band Information Society to be Ion Storm's sound designer. Sverre Kvernmo, a star mapper from the Doom community, left his home country of Norway to become Romero's lead-level designer. These weren't hard sacrifices for them to make. "We were all starstruck by the Romero phenomenon," Sverre said. Few were more struck than Stevie Case. Stevie was the University of Kansas Quake fan who had become known as one of the sharpest shooting players on the scene. During a pilgrimage to Dallas, she'd managed to score a death match with Romero. She lost, but just barely, and challenged him to a rematch. The next time around, Romero got clocked. As penance, he uploaded a web shrine in Stevie's honor. Later, he offered her a job. Stevie and the other gamers weren't the only ones enamored. The press rejoiced over the vision of Ion Storm. Anyone who visited the temporary office was treated to the spirit of a real game company. Deathmatching wasn't just permitted, it was celebrated. At any given moment, Romero and dozens of others would be screaming obscenities while hunting each other down in Quake. Working with id's former PR company in New York, Mike regaled the press about an office that, when built out, would be the Willy Wonka chocolate factory of gaming, complete with an in-house movie theater, a massive game room, and a specially designed area of network computers made specifically for deathmatching. Time named Romero among the country's top 50 cyber elite. Fortune anointed Ion Storm one of the country's 25 cool companies. Eidos sent the Ion Storm owners on a whirlwind champagne and limousine press tour, which Mike cheekily dubbed the No Excuses Tour, since these were game designers who were finally in the position, essentially, to put up or shut up. Mike described the group as the Fab Four of gaming, which pleased the guys to no end. Todd even suggested they take a picture of them crossing Abbey Road. But, behind the scenes, everyone knew who this company was about, John Romero. Ion painted itself as the place of freedom and dreams, while id was the out-of-touch oppressor. It was about not just two companies, but two visions: design versus technology, art versus science, Dionysus versus Apollo. "Id is a technology-oriented company," said Mike Wilson, "whereas our main focus is to indulge our artistic sensibilities." At id, by the time the 3D engine was finished, there wasn't enough time to work on aspects of the game. "We didn't think this was a well-balanced approach." Romero agreed. "After I left," he told Wired News, "the mood at id turned dark and gloomy. No more plans to expand the company, no one to confront Carmack on important issues. I want to create more types of games with no limits on creativity, and I want as many resources, i.e. people, as I need to get the job done. That is why I left." Romero told the Times of London that within 2 years, Ion Storm would surpass id as the market leader. "It's going to happen," he said, "and it'll be great." Carmack was pulling into the parking lot of id's Black Cube office building when he heard the crash. It was a terrible sound. The sound of his cherry red Ferrari F40 getting swiped by a pickup truck. No sooner could he react than the truck peeled out of the lot and into the blur of traffic nearby. Carmack inspected the gruesome damage, then stomped upstairs and vented in a dot plan file. "Words cannot do justice to how I feel right now," he typed. "If anyone knows a tall white male in the Dallas area that now has red paint and carbon fiber on their tan pickup truck, turn the bastard in." Among the respondents was John Romero. "The F-40 got hit," Romero posted online. "Karma." This wasn't the first snipe from Romero. Every day, it seemed, someone from the office would wander in with some new outrage Romero had told the press. It was bad enough that he kept deriding id as an out-of-touch technology company. Worse, the id guys thought he was claiming sole credit for their success. Even Romero's official press release broadly credited him with being responsible for the programming, design, and project management of the id's games. And Journalists eagerly and lazily picked up the refrain, calling Romero the creative talent behind id and the man responsible for creating the blockbusters Doom and Quake. Such comments were becoming the talk of id. Though they knew the press was often misleading, Romero sure didn't seem to be taking an active role in trying to correct the misconceptions. It quickly became fashionable in the office to bash Romero and Ion Storm. American posted a .plan file mocking Romero's claim of having made id. Adrian and Kevin grumbled about how they were going to sink Romero's ship. But no one took up the war like id's new artist and Carmack's new friend, Paul Steed. Paul was the antithesis of a computer game geek. Tough, muscular, inscribed with tattoos, Paul had been abandoned by his father and spent the transient childhood up and down the eastern seaboard. He had an early interest in computers, but gave it up for other pursuits. "Either you stay up all night chasing that program you want to write," he said, "or you stay up all night chasing girls. For me, women won out." Though talented, he grew into a volatile, confrontational personality, eventually getting thrown out of military school for a classroom brawl. He retreated to the computer world and took a job as an artist for Origin. The job at id was a dream, Paul thought, when he was presented with the offer. He didn't know he'd be walking into a war. Paul didn't know much about John Romero, other than that id's estranged co-founder kept making surprise visits to Suite 666, as if he still wanted to be friends. Romero's visits angered the staff, particularly Kevin and Adrian, who resented him behaving as if he were not trashing id in the press. "Why is that fucker coming over here all the time?" Paul would hear them complain. Finally, Paul spoke up. "Fuck Romero and his company," he said. "Let's just show up in his office and see what happens." The next day, Paul, Adrian, and Kevin paid a visit to Ion Storm's temporary office space near downtown Dallas. Romero was surprised to see them, but showed them around nonetheless. Paul noticed that one of Romero's artists seemed to be using an antiquated program to create his animations. So he came back to id and questioned Ion's direction in a public .plan file. The comment ignited what became known as the .plan wars. Id and Ion employees began disparaging each other on a daily basis. Romero eventually jumped in, sending Paul a cheeky email asking him if he'd endorsed Daikatana on the back of the game's box. Paul showed Adrian the email and suggested he retaliate. Adrian was more than happy to give Paul his blessing. "Dude," Paul wrote to Romero, "don't fuck with me, because I'll grab you by your ludicrously long hair and kick your ass back into the Doom days where you wish you were." Carmack, up until this point, had stayed aloof. But as the competitive bile built in the office, even he felt himself getting swept up in the fervor. So, in what he described as an experiment in mood manipulation, Carmack decided to feel what it was like to take the gloves off. He chose quite a forum for his first public salvo, Time Magazine. In an interview for a two-page profile of Romero, Carmack set the record straight that, contrary to his ex-partner's frequent assertions, Romero didn't quit. He was fired. After he got rich and famous, the push to work just wasn't there anymore, Carmack said. He was handed his resignation. He scoffed at Romero's ambitions for fame and fortune, saying, "There's only so many Ferraris I want to own." And he added that there was no chance Romero would fulfill his promise of finishing Daikatana in time for Christmas. Romero retorted in the same story that id was too limiting, too small thinking, which did little to quell the id-ion deathmatch. The skirmish became even more public with the approach of the Electronic Entertainment Expo, the video game industry's massive annual convention, where companies demo their latest, greatest games. Id had every confidence that its showing, Quake 2, would not only outshine John Romero's Daikatana, but crush it. Since work had begun on Quake 2 in September 1996, it had been shaping up to be the most cohesive and technologically impressive id game yet. The idea had come from a 1961 World War II movie called The Guns of Navarone, in which the heroes must take out two giant enemy guns that reside in a mountain fortress on a remote island. It was the perfect theme, the guys at id thought, something that could give their game not just a militaristic milieu, but a narrative, a purpose, which had never really been in an id game before. In Quake 2, players would be cast as Marines doing battle on the evil planet of Stragos, where mutant Strogs have been hoarding human limbs and flesh to build a lethal race of cyborgs. The object? Take out the Strogs before they conquer humankind. To do this, players would have to take out the weapon protecting the alien species, the Big Gun. The technology would bring this world to life. Though Carmack didn't consider his new engine nearly as great a leap as Quake, it was still going to be formidable. Most significant? Quake 2 would run with either software or hardware acceleration. This meant that someone running a new 3DFX card could get exceptional special effects, colored lighting, smoother surfaces, a more fluid cinematic feel. Under the leadership of Kevin Cloud, who was always the most diplomatic and organized of the owners, id's troop took on its own militaristic approach. With the deathmatching days over, the long hours proceeded with quiet intensity. The Shreveport Swamp Band of the past, Tom, Romero, Jay, Mike, was replaced with a regime that fulfilled Carmack's conservative vision, including a new CEO, Todd Hollinshead, a former tax consultant at Arthur Andersen, and Tim Willits, the company's new lead designer. Carmack uncharacteristically effused. "I doubt I can convey just how well things are going here," he posted on June 16, 1997, in his .plan file, just before attending the Electronic Entertainment Expo, aka E3. "Things probably look a little odd from the outside, but our work should speak for itself. I have been breaking into spontaneous smiles lately, just thinking about how cool things are. Of course, that could just be a sleep deprivation effect. We have a totally kick-ass team here. We are on schedule. No shit. We are doing a great product. Everyone, watch out." The 1997 E3 convention in Atlanta was not just devoted to video games. It was a video game. Stepping inside the main floor was like walking into the heart of a machine. Flashing lights, pounding rock, skateboarders, and the ubiquitous booth babes, actresses, models, and strippers who dressed up like video game vixens and pressed the gamer's eager flesh. The babe of the moment was Lara Croft, protagonist of Tomb Raider. As lines of attendees with plastic bags of giveaway toys lined up to play games, the Laras worked the floor. But they couldn't compete with the real star of the show, the long-haired guy walking through the halls and leaving a trail of bowing gamers in his wake. "We're not worthy! We're not worthy! We're not worthy!" the gamers cooed to John Romero, or, as he was lately referring to himself, God. Romero had accepted the divine moniker as a tongue-in-cheek descriptor of himself in his .plan file, but it wasn't entirely a joke. As far as the press and fans were concerned, Romero was a rock god. He was everywhere. Computer Gaming World, The Wall Street Journal, Fortune, on covers, in color, regal. In an ad for a joystick, Romero wore a crown and flowing red robe to give, as the tagline declared, the royal seal of approval. "If you want to crack skulls with the big boys," Romero's quote read, "the Panther XL is the weapon of choice." His publicity stills featured him sitting in a $9,000 medieval chair he had bought for his Tudor mansion. Romero looked more royal than ever. He was dressing in tight-fitting designer shirts, jewelry. He had let his hair grow out so that it flowed to the middle of his back. His mane had become so renowned that in an online interview, he dispensed his own 10-step plan for grooming. "I always flip my hair over in front of my face and look at the floor while using a brush and hairdryer to slowly dry all my hair. Brushing downward while drying will help straighten your hair, and completely drying it will make sure it doesn't kink up or curl up. Walking through the kaleidoscopic floor show of E3, Romero buzzed and beamed as brightly as the games around him, but he was not there to preen. He was there, as everyone in attendance was keenly aware, to unveil a demonstration of Daikatana. From the day production began in March 1997, Romero had promised the game for a Christmas 1997 release, which meant that, by now, it would be nearly halfway to completion. Romero thought this was more than doable since he had assembled such a large team, 8 artists versus id's 2, for example, to get the job done. Though Carmack had publicly expressed skepticism, the gamers and press were frothing at the bit. They had reason to feel piqued. Between the rock and roll showmanship of Mike Wilson, the hyperbolic confidence of Romero, and the multi-million-dollar vested interest of Eidos, Ion Storm had pulled out all the stops to hype the game. And, with one ad in particular, a lot of people thought they had finally gone too far. Earlier in the year, on the suggestion of Mike Wilson, Romero had agreed to an ad that would emulate the cheeky bravado of Deathmatch Smack Talk, the very language Romero had helped define. But when he saw the words in print, he felt a tinge of hesitation. "Are you sure about this?" he asked Mike. "Yeah," Mike said. "Don't be a pussy." Romero agreed. The ad ran in all the major gaming publications in April, with simply these words written in black against a red background. "John Romero's about to make you his bitch." Underneath was the tagline, "Suck it down," a phrase Mike had recently trademarked. The ad achieved its intended effect, and then some. Gamers were not only provoked, they were pissed. Who did Romero think he was? Had all this fame gotten to his head? But they were willing to give him a chance to see if his game would really be, as he was promising, the coolest one planet Earth had ever seen. Since it was coming from the ego at id, the surgeon of Wolfenstein, Doom, and Quake, they certainly wanted to believe. At E3, they were ready for their first chance. The Daikatana demo was front and center in the Eidos booth, right alongside promos for the much-anticipated Tomb Raider sequel. The demo of the game's Norway level was made especially for this event, and gamers crowded around the screens to see it. Gone were the dark mazes of Doom and Quake. Instead, scenes were outdoors, with blankets of snow covering little Norwegian cottages, teasing glimpses of ancient Greek temples. Gamers were complimentary, but not ecstatic. When Romero wandered over to id's booth, he found out why. He pushed his way through the crowd to see the demo of Quake 2. His face filled with yellow light as his jaw slackened. Colored lighting. Romero couldn't believe what he was seeing. The setting was a dungeon-like military level, but when the gamer fired his gun, the yellow blast of the ammunition cast a corresponding yellow glow as it sailed down the walls. It was subtle, but when Romero saw the dynamic colored lighting, it was a moment just like that one back at Soft Disk when he saw Dangerous Dave in copyright infringement for the first time. "Holy fuck," he muttered. Carmack had done it again. Romero thought Quake 2 was the best thing he had ever seen on a computer. By programming the game specifically to take advantage of hardware acceleration, Carmack had forged a true thing of beauty. Colored lighting brought the world magnificently to life. This was the next wave, Romero knew. Carmack's game was also, alas, his competition. The difference between his game and id's was like that between a piece of paper and a color TV set, Romero thought. There's no way in hell Daikatana can come out against this, not the way this looks. Part of Romero's license deal with id was that he could upgrade to use their next engine, but he'd never anticipated the leap would be so great. Now, he knew he had to scrap all the existing work on Daikatana and redo the game using the Quake 2 engine. But there was a problem. id's contract specifically stipulated that a licensee couldn't use the new engine until id's game was on the shelves. This meant that Romero would not get the Quake II engine until after Christmas. He would have to finish Daikatana using the existing technology, then spend about a month, he estimated, converting it when he got the Quake II engine. Carmex technology had once again forced him to change his plans. Later in the show, the gamers made their way to the other main event, the Red Annihilation Deathmatch Tournament sponsored by id. In the middle of the floor was the grand prize, Carmax Cherry Red Ferrari 328. I bought my first Ferrari after the success of Wolfenstein 3D, Carmack told the press. Doom and Quake have bought three more. Four Ferraris is too many for me. Rather than sell off one of them or stick it in a warehouse, I'm going to give it back to the gamers that brought it to me in the first place. The king of this Quake deathmatch is going to get a really cool crown. More than 2,000 gamers had been competing online for the right to be one of the 16 flown to E3 to compete. Everyone was gathered for the finals, which came down to Tom Entropy Kismi, the sharpshooting clan member of the University of Kansas's Impulse 9, and Dennis Thresh Fong, winner of the first official deathmatch event, Microsoft's Judgment Day. The two sat on stage in front of Carmack's car, which bore the license plate IDTech 1. With the crowd cheering, they battled as their match played out on a large overhead screen. Thresh could see the reflection of the Ferrari in his monitor as he closed in for his final slaying, winning the deathmatch 13-1. Carmack walked on stage and handed Thresh the keys. "So how are you planning on getting the car home?" he asked. "I don't know," Thresh said. "I guess I'll ship it." Carmack came back a half hour later and handed Thresh $5,000 in cash to cover the costs. As the crowd cleared, Romero wandered up to see who was around from id. Just because they were competitors didn't mean they couldn't be friends. He found Carmack and a couple of other id guys gathered near some computers. They talked about the event, and then it was suggested that they have a go at deathmatching each other. Romero beat everyone until it came down to just him and Carmack. The two Johns sat at their machines and faced off. It was funny how the games had taken on such different meanings over the years. They'd played Super Mario back in Shreveport when the world was full of possibilities and id was just an idea from the deep. They'd played F-Zero, the hovercraft racing game, in Wisconsin to escape the cold and dream of the race cars they could someday afford to own. They had played Doom, that very first deathmatch, which foretold the fame and fortune to come. And now they were competing for the first time in Quake, the game that had finally torn them apart. In all those long months of development, they had never played each other. On cue, they were off, blasting rocket launchers at each other through the halls. No sooner had it begun than Romero, the surgeon, made giblets of Engine John. This match was over. The next one would take place in an even more challenging arena, the one where Quake II and Daikatana were destined to meet. And this world guaranteed competition and surprises of its own. Chapter 14. Silicon Alamo. Brother Jake stood behind the bar of the Horny Toad Cantina in Mesquite, mixing up another big fucking gun. One part Rumplemintz, one part Midori, with a splash of blue curacao. The BFG was a drink he'd concocted in honor of his favorite weapon from Doom. It was the least he could do, considering the cantina was right across the highway from id's office. The toxic green cocktail was the unofficial toast of Dallas, the new capital of the video game gold rush. By the summer of 1997, Dallas had become to gamers what Seattle was to musicians in the early 1990s. id was Nirvana. In the 5 years since the two Johns had rolled into town with a Pac-Man machine in the back of their truck, the game developer community there had more than tripled. The growth extended to Austin, where just as many were popping up around Richard Garriott's flagship company, Origin. Time called the Texas gamers the New Cowboys. Wired called them Doom Babies, The Boston Globe dubbed the state's video game renaissance the New Hollywood. A more appropriate name would have been Silicon Alamo, because the crux of the rush was first-person shooters. Between Doom, Quake, and Scott Miller's hit Duke Nukem 3D, shooters had spawned a multi-million dollar cottage industry and dominated the video game charts. This fulfilled the dream that id had set out to accomplish back at SoftDisk, to make the PC a viable gaming platform. Of the $3.7 billion generated in 1996 from interactive entertainment software, nearly half, $1.7 billion, was from PC games alone. The PC gaming boom, declared USA Today, has helped the industry bounce back. With the prospects of id's and Ion's fame and fortune, a new generation of companies were arising around Dallas. Rogue and Ritual, spawned respectively from id and 3D Realms, specialized in making so-called mission packs, add-on levels for Quake. Ensemble Studios, empowered by the addition of id's Sandy Peterson, created one of the best-selling strategy games of all time, Age of Empires. Terminal Realty, founded by ex-Apogee members and the creator of Microsoft's groundbreaking flight simulator engine, devoted itself to a range of multi-platform gaming products. The Cyber Athlete Professional League was trying to turn live deathmatching events into the gaming version of the NFL. id did much to increase the community by licensing out its technology. In addition to IonStorm, other companies were now paying close to $250,000, as well as royalties, to use the Quake engine. Though id would profit from some of its competition, there was more on the rise. Soon, the gaming press began speculating about the Quake killers that would or could knock id from its perch. Duke Nukem 3D had already received much acclaim. Valve, a Seattle-based company founded by some former Microsoft employees, had licensed the Quake engine to make Half-Life, a game that had previewed at E3 to a favorable response. Unreal, a shooter created by Epic, the North Carolina company discovered by Scott Miller years before, had demoed as well to laudable reviews. Then, of course, there was Daikatana. With all these games due sometime over the next year, as well as id's own Quake 2, the Silicon Alamo Showdown promised to be one of the best shootouts in years, if only those involved could survive the battles brewing in their own companies. The race was on. Carmack was behind the wheel of his Ferrari F40, burning down the drag strip as the Porsche 911 stormed up behind him. It was a bright, sunny day in Ennis, Texas. Carmack had decided to rent out this country racetrack for a little company competition. It was a fun way for everyone to flex the power of the sports cars the games had afforded them. This wasn't the only track they had been visiting of late. In a pinch, Carmack had once called the mayor of Mesquite and asked him if he would shut down the local airport long enough for the company to have a few little drag races. The mayor was happy to oblige. Carmack, after all, had donated tens of thousands of dollars of equipment, including bulletproof vests, which some gamer on the force stitched with Doom patches, to the local police. He deserved consideration. The drag races weren't the only contests in town. Though Quake 2 was the favorite shooter at E3, the pressure inside id was mounting. Carmack had absolved himself of his competitive mood manipulation test, determining that such motivation didn't suit his circuitry, but the rest of the guys were hardly resigned. Other companies' shooters, even id's own licensees, became regular subjects of ridicule. When the first demo of Half-Life came through the doors, many insisted it would do nothing less than fail. The company, like Quake 2, had grown militaristic and serious. For some, all the fun and humor seemed to have been sucked out of id, not just figuratively, but literally, with most of the fun people, Romero, Mike, Jay, Sean, all out the door. In place was real-life competition that had begun against Romero and now spread among themselves. American and others blamed Carmack, who sequestered himself in his office, for passive-aggressively encouraging the conflict. One of the main sources of distrust among the employees was id's competitive bonus structure. Every quarter or so, the owners would meet to assign a dollar amount to each employee. They would then split up a bonus payment based on these decisions. One quarter, someone might get $100,000. The next, $20,000. The owners admitted that it was an arbitrary and imperfect plan, but it was the only one they could surmise. As a result, the employees realized that the easiest way to get the higher bonuses was to outwit, outplay, and outsmart each other. It was a business death match. With Romero out of the picture, the competition had only grown more fierce. Though American had been the golden boy during the early days of Quake, those days were over. Carmack had turned cold, American thought, making him feel like he was never sure if they were really friends. For Carmack, American was just another casualty of self, someone with talent who'd lost his drive and focus, like Romero. As a result, Tim Willits, American's old adversary, swiftly moved into favor, triggering rampant infighting. More and more, Carmack wanted to grab his laptop and disappear into a hotel room in some strange state. All he wanted to do was code. That was all he had ever wanted. The problems at id, he thought, were precisely the kinds of problems that he could avoid by keeping the company small, the team tight. For any given project, he posted in his dot plan file online, there is some team size beyond which adding more people will actually cause things to take longer. This is due to loss of efficiency from chopping up problems, communication overhead, and just plain entropy. It's even easier to reduce quality by adding people. I contend that the max programming team size for id is very small. With Romero gone, Carmack's life could aspire to the elegance of his code. Simple, efficient, lean. This was how he would lead his company. This was how he would make his games. He would not succumb to internal pressures or grand aspirations that would lead to infinite delays. He would deliver. And on December 9th, 1997, he did just that. Oh my God, Quake 2 is the most impressive game I've ever played on a computer. What game have you played lately that was better than Quake 2? I predict the answer is none. Among the most gushing reviews, and there were many, of Quake 2, was this one from Romero. He posted it on December 11th in his dot plan file, 2 days after the game was released. Romero had burned through non-stop for 48 hours, completing the entire game in one long twitch. He had reason to be excited. By licensing the Quake 2 engine, Romero was assured that he could implement all the tricks of the game, including colored lighting, in Daikatana. Not only was he making what he thought was the most ambitious shooter ever created, but he would be able to do it using the most ambitious engine ever created. It was finally like the ultimate collaboration, a marriage of technology and design that Romero could never achieve at id. And now, best of all, no one, not Carmack, not anyone, could get in the way. Or so he thought. The burgeoning troops of Ion Storm were grumbling with discontent. It had begun when Ion released the bitch ad in April. Just as that backlash was stinging, the company went to E3 in June 1997 with what many thought to be a shabby demo of Daikatana. Romero seemed more interested in playing games and courting the press, they thought, than in telling them what they needed to do to realize his game. And the game, as a result, was feeling further and further from completion. Unlike Romero, most of his staff didn't like the idea of switching Daikatana to the Quake 2 technology. In fact, they hated it. Romero seemed to have no idea how much work it was going to take just to implement the bare essentials of his 400-page Daikatana design document. He wanted 64 monsters, 4 time zones, a game 4 times the size of Quake. They'd have trouble meeting the new March 1998 deadline without the pressure of switching technologies. Now, how are they going to handle this? They weren't the only ones with suspicions after E3. Eidos was not pleased to find out that Ion Storm's flagship title was now going to miss the Christmas season. But the Eidos executives were willing to give Romero the benefit of the doubt. Romero assured them, as he assured his staff, that the game would be pushed back only a few months. Bodies plus manpower, he said, was going to be the formula of success. The company already had 80 people, and it was still growing. With all those people at work, of course the work would get completed. Just look at what we did at id with barely 13 guys. Eidos had no choice but to take his word, since he was managing the development of the game without intervention on their part. For all they knew, the game really was just a few months from hitting the shelves, and they were willing to do whatever it took to help make that happen. What that took was money. After less than a year, Eidos's original $13 million deal, which was supposed to fund all three games, was starting to dwindle away. 80 people on staff meant 80 salaries, and with two computers per person, 160 state-of-the-art machines with 21-inch monitors. The office renovations were now approaching the $2 million mark. In all, there was no end in sight. Something had to be done. Mike Wilson, Ion's marketing whiz, had a plan. Ever since his days at id, Mike had dreamed of running his own publishing company. And he'd made this dream clear to Romero and the other owners of Ion the moment he came on board. They even nicknamed the plan Ion Strike, which would be the self-publishing wing they'd start once they'd finished their obligation to Eidos. Mike couldn't believe that Romero, unbeknownst to him, had signed not a three-game deal with Eidos, as he had expected, but a deal that gave them the option on three more. This meant that Ion received $13 million for its first three games, and when presented with the next three game ideas, Eidos could decide whether to fund them as well. The faster they burned through the options, the faster they'd get their cash and be on their way to Ion Strike. The time now was to burn. The first deal made to cash in on this plan was to acquire Dominion, which Todd Porter had begun at 7th level. The game was languishing at Todd's former company, and he convinced the other owners that it was the perfect fit for Ion. They could simply buy it for $1.8 million, and it would take him only 6 weeks or so to get it out the door. Then he'd finish the game he was originally planning to do, Doppelganger. They made the deal, but it was only the beginning. In September 1997, Romero had heard through the grapevine that a game designer named Warren Spector was looking for somewhere to go. At 41 years old, Warren was a well-regarded veteran of the industry. The son of a dentist and a reading teacher in New York, he had grown up intellectual and academic. While pursuing a doctorate in radio, television, and film at the University of Texas at Austin in the late 1970s, Warren fell in with the town's burgeoning community of science fiction authors and gamers, eventually taking a job with Richard Garriott's company, Origin. Games, for him, were not just diversions. They were the closest thing to artificial reality. "There's never been a medium in the history of mankind that can literally put you in another world," he said. "We're stuck here. But with the right balance of story and technology, a good game can get close. This is the only medium ever that lets ordinary people travel to other worlds. I am never going to fly a World War I biplane. I'm never going to visit a space station. I'm never going to be a super spy. But when I play one of these games, I am." As id popularized what he thought were mindless first-person shooters,